If you're just tuning in, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We're talking avalanches with John Sykes, a forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center, and Nick D'Alessio, a backcountry guide based out of Girdwood. We're also talking to Sean Sullivan, a snow machiner in Nikiski, though he's dipping in and out of the call as we're going. So we've kind of been talking about some general avalanche safety ideas and, you know, what people can do to make sure that they're prepared. But we haven't really talked that much about actual conditions. And that's something I kind of want to talk about. So it would be nice to kind of give people some practical tips about what they can do when they're going into the backcountry and kind of how they can look out for this. And if you're listening and you have any questions, you can shoot me an email. My email is spoux@kdll.org. Shoot me an email with any questions you have for our guests. So of course there are lots of factors that go into when and how an avalanche might occur. And I'm not expecting us to run through all of those right now, but, you know, I'm curious myself, what are kind of some baseline conditions that people can use to determine whether there might be danger? What's kind of like a first step someone can take? Maybe John, you want to start with that one.
I would love to start with that one. Throwing me the low hanging fruit. There's a really important set of five things that we look at in avalanche train. They're called the red flags, and you're going to see them in basically every avalanche course. The first one is recent avalanches. So you should be looking for recent avalanches. That's the biggest indication that you're going to have that the conditions are prime for avalanches, right? Makes sense, but it also can be, you know, easy to put your head down and not be looking and kind of miss signs when you're out there. So it's really important to be observant.
And you're talking about looking at a slope and kind of seeing a slide just from the road.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. From the road or as you're skinning up or riding up the up track, even across the valley. Any sign of a recent avalanche is going to be meaningful. And what you're kind of looking for, a typical shape of an avalanche, they have a crown at the top. So it's going to be kind of a defined change in the depth of the snowpack at the top. And then on the sides, they're called the flanks. And it's going to look similar. It's like a cut in the snow depth on the side. So it almost looks like somebody took some scissors and cut out a section of the snow. That's what you're going to be looking
for. Nice. I like the set of vocabulary words that we're learning here too.
Yeah. And then the last vocabulary word is the debris field below. It's going to be, the snow is going to be all broken up and kind of piled into a big chunk at the bottom. So those are the classic signs.
Gotcha. So that's the first thing to look out for.
That's the first red flag. All right. And the second one is called shooting cracks or collapses. And so this basically means that you've triggered an avalanche or you've triggered a collapse, but something about the terrain or the snowpack means that it wasn't able to release, but you have all the necessary ingredients. Like Sully was talking about earlier, you have a steep slope, you have a slab and you have a weak layer, and then you're the trigger in this case. So what a shooting crack and a collapse is as you're traveling through the mountains, if you're stepping on the snow or riding through the snow, sometimes you'll notice that the snow will fracture and it'll travel out in front of you. So you literally get like a crack in the surface of the snow. And that's showing you that the snow on the surface is acting like a slab, which is another kind of vocabulary term. So slab avalanches are the ones that we're mostly interested in, where most people get caught in. That shooting crack is an indication that the slab is acting as a cohesive layer and that it's potential to separate in an avalanche. And then the collapse is actually a sound that you can hear. It's often called a woomph, but you'll be traveling through the mountains and all of a sudden you'll hear this kind of, it's a woomph.
A woomph
is a descriptive word
for
it.
That is the best onomatopoeia I've ever heard. Woomph.
You will know if you trigger one.
Okay.
It can be a little hair raising when this happens, especially if you're anywhere near a steep slope. But essentially you've collapsed a weak layer. And so that's the first part of triggering an avalanche. The shooting cracks and whoops are the second red flag.
Can't get over that word, the whoomph. That's so great. Yeah.
There's many different spellings.
Yeah.
You can choose your own. Yeah, the next one is a little more straightforward. So if we've had more than a foot of snow or an inch of rain, like an inch of water, that's a red flag that there's a bunch of new weight on the snowpack. So if there is a weak layer somewhere in there, that added weight is going to stress the weak layer out. So it's more likely to release. The fourth one is active wind loading. So like right now, we've had a bunch of storms in the past couple of weeks that have been putting down pretty low density snow, like light, fluffy snow. And if it starts to, if the wind starts to blow a bunch, that snow is going to get pushed around in the mountains. And it can get kind of, if it all gets pushed into the same spot, it can create a big slab, which could become an avalanche. So that wind loading is a big deal. It can transport snow really quickly and create dangerous avalanche conditions really quickly. The nice thing about it is you can kind of see it. You can see where the wind is blowing. If there's snow coming off the ridges, you can see that, or you can look kind of at the textures of the snow and see where the wind is coming from and where it's going to.
So gotcha.
One of the fun puzzling exercises you do when you're out backcountry touring, figure out where the wind's blowing. And then the last one is rapid warming above freezing temperatures. So if we have really dramatic changes in temperature, that can also be a red flag for avalanches. So
wow. Is there an acronym to remember all of those red flags?
I don't know if there's an, I'm not a big acronym guy. I just call them the red flags, but
we'll have to think of one. I'm a big acronym girl, so I'm gonna, yeah. I'll get to work on that.
I'll leave it up to you, but yeah, if you please do it, it'll come up. Yeah.
Very cool. That's really good to know. And yeah, I imagine when you're out in the backcountry and you're kind of focused on so many different things, it's not as easy to remember these red flags as when you're kind of just sitting down by yourself thinking about this beforehand. So, you know, I imagine it's good to kind of familiarize yourself with these prior to going out so that they're kind of, that it just all comes, becomes kind of second nature.
Definitely.
I mean, do you remember a point in your career when this sort of thing became more second nature and you didn't have to think about it so much?
I think for me personally, it was mostly about spending just a lot of time in the mountains. I took an avalanche class pretty early. I didn't really have any experience in avalanche terrain or backcountry skiing when I took my first avalanche class. And then I started spending a bunch of time in avalanche terrain, and I just kind of slowly accumulated the knowledge. I think it becomes a little more intuitive when you're familiar with kind of what the snow feels like and what the conditions feel like when you're traveling through the mountains. It's a little difficult to explain, but maybe Nick or somebody could do a better job than I did.
Thank you. Nick, go ahead.
I can jump in there a little bit. I would just, yeah, absolutely. John's right. I mean, those red flags, if there's one thing you know about snowpack, is understanding these red flags, committing them to memory. And if you're out there for a day, any day, and you see any one of those red flags, there is no question. It's a dangerous day. It's that simple. If you see an avalanche that happens or a recent avalanche that looks fresh, it's like, you don't need to be digging a snow pit. You don't need to have a master's degree like John has in snow science. You don't have to be getting your PhD. Like, there's no question. It's dangerous. The important part, or the hard part maybe, is, you know, once you know them, you know them. But the problem is that people try to make, you know, we're humans, right? And we make excuses or like, oh, well, you know, that avalanche is there. Where we're going is fine. And
right. We don't want to see the red flags. We ignore the red flags.
We have these confirmation biases, yes. Right? Where we like, oh, that avalanche, nah, that's fine. So that's really the hardest part is just our own human brains. And, you know, with that too, it's like you see an avalanche happen and you know, you'll know like, okay, that's the number one red flag. It's dangerous, but you'll see someone potentially go rip up a slope or ski down a slope and nothing happens, right? And the problem with snow is that it's this poor learning feedback environment and you get away with things and there's no way to know like how close were you to that line of it releasing and avalanching, and you get away with it and you get away with it and you get away with it, and it shows you, it teaches you that you're like, I'm doing a good job, like, oh yeah, pat myself on the back, you know. But you can't do that forever. I mean, probability is going to catch up with you. So I would just encourage everybody. I think the thing that I've learned mostly over the last few years of my life is patience, right? And just really having patience with the snow, and just when in doubt, like Sully said earlier,
throttle out. When in doubt, throttle out.
When in doubt, throttle out. Yeah, when in doubt, you know, terrain's your answer, and you back it off in the terrain angle. And I mean, I think there's a misconception as a ski guide, and as a heli ski guide, that like we're skiing all the gnarly ski film stuff all the time. But in reality, I'm skiing a lot of low angle stuff all year long. And I wait and I wait and I wait and I wait. And then it all lines up where it's like, okay, our snowpack is healed. It's strong. We've got good weather. We've got good people together. Let's send it, you know. But honestly, I mean, I ski, I don't know how many, I don't really keep track, but I probably ski somewhere around up to 200 days a year. And I mean, the amount of days where I'm skiing full on avalanche terrain is down to the, I can count them on two hands for the entire season probably.
Wow. That's really good to know. That's, yeah. I mean, you, as you mentioned, and I want to ask both you and Sully about this, because I mentioned before that you kind of ski all over. And we were talking a little bit before about the climactic differences in different parts of South Central. I mean, just when we're talking about the mountains that are within driving distance from this part of the Kenai Peninsula, Nick, what are kind of some of those differences that you take into account when you're skiing different parts of South Central?
Sure. I mean, I think the main thing to know is that snowpack changes over distance. One mountain to the next mountain, and more so like one valley to the next valley. So the weather, you know, the mountains create these microclimates. And so the Girdwood Turingen Pass area is going to be a lot different than the Summit Lake area or down the Eastern Kenai Mountains, or Seward, and definitely very different than like the Anchorage Front Range or up in Hatcher Pass, north of Palmer and Wasilla there, you know. And so you have to, whenever I go into a new zone that I haven't been to before, that season or ever, I just really try to have a mindset of having fresh eyes and take it from square one again, all over again. And, you know, I think the big word these days is like uncertainty levels, and you adjust your uncertainty levels as you gather more information or less, or have less information. And so in an area where I live in Girdwood, right, I can look out my window and I have a professional avalanche forecast in Turingen Pass area, my uncertainty level generally creeps up a little bit. It might go down a little bit, but it's generally on the higher side, right? Uncertainty. I'm saying that backwards. Lower uncertainty, right? But if I go to an area where I haven't been to before, or especially like take a snow machine or an airplane out to the middle of the mountains, I mean, my uncertainty level is extremely high, and you have to adjust your mindset and wait and gather information yourself until you can ramp up the, or potentially ramp up your slope angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sully, you're kind of our voice of the peninsula here. Do you do a lot of snow machining on kind of this, the northern part of the Kenai Peninsula? Is this a place you come a lot as well?
Absolutely. You know, and I recreate the entire state. And some of that is because I'm teaching, you know, everywhere from Homer to Fairbanks. Working for the Avalanche School has been pretty cool, because I've gotten to travel and meet lots of great people in different areas of our wonderful state. As far as the Kenai Peninsula, we got this place called the Caribou Hills. So everybody that's listening, I'm sure they know of it. And it's, you know, not a lot of elevation, you know, so it's not comparable like to the mountains per se, you know, when you're doing big climbs and you think of these giant avalanches that we see depicted in movies and on televisions and in our minds, right? They're much smaller slopes, and those smaller slopes, similar to Cantwell in the front part of Cantwell or the Dutch Hills, those smaller slopes can still produce avalanches that can bury you and kill you. So that being said, I have lots and lots of hours out here, and I haven't seen much. And again, that doesn't mean that they don't exist, but we do get very comfortable in the terrain that we're in, because maybe it's your backyard and you live there, And that's one of our human factors. And we just start becoming numb to the area that we're riding because we go there all the time and there's never any danger. And then there's that one storm or that one freeze, and then there's some frost on the ground, and then there's a weak layer that becomes created, and then there's that one storm where the snow is just a little bit different, a little bit temperature than it normally is, and you go ride that same little bowl that you always ride, and this time it cuts loose and it buries you. So just because you're in smaller terrain doesn't mean that it's not avalanche terrain. That being said, if you're going to head north, you know, the closest place to ride would be like Carter Lake area, when you get into Cooper Landing, and that produces a ton of avalanches if you go in from that side. Not necessarily this time of year because the snow is kind of killer right now up in there probably. I'm pretty sure I haven't been there, but I would imagine it's just pow shots all day. But as soon as springtime
hits... Is that the scientific term, pow shots?
I use a lot of really scientific terms, so just bear with me. But in the springtime, you'll go in and everything will be rock hard in the morning because it froze all night. And then it starts warming up. And on your way out, everything that you were riding in is on the ground. And it's all avalanched. Your tracks are all gone and buried. And if you would have been riding there later in the afternoon, like maybe some people do, you know, you would be experiencing avalanche conditions one-on-one. And we don't want to do that. So... depends on the time of year. The snowpack changes, right? I don't know. I was gone for a little bit, but I'm sure these guys talked about it. You know, depending on the weather and the sun and what's happening in the ground and all kinds of different things.
Well, so we talked about go ahead. Sorry.
Nope. Just another good reason to, you know, I think when I left off, I was talking about risk acceptance and, you know, you might see somebody doing something crazy, like in a movie. Right. Like Nick was talking about, and we see these ski movies and these snow machine movies, and they're just jumping off of monster stuff and going on these crazy, you know, these crazy climbs and everything. Well, they have entire crews just like we do when we go riding. We take advantage of everybody that has all that knowledge, and they're not just hucking it. I mean, sometimes, but most of the times they're doing tons of homework and they're going, we can't film that today. We can't film that today. We can't film that today. Day 11. Okay. We can film it. So then we can get a hit on it. You know, kind of lost my train. I got somebody coming in here. I'll join back up with you guys here in a little bit.
Great. Well, you mentioned, time, and I actually think timing is not really something that we've touched too much on. I mean, so we're having this conversation. It's the first day of December. This time of year, are there any kind of specific considerations? I know in terms of regulations, there are specific things to take into account. Like there was an opener for snow machiners, actually, I think beginning today in the past. But John, is there kind of anything about this time of year in particular that folks should be cognizant of when they're going out there?
Yeah. Especially specific for this season, there's a lot of glide cracks this time of year. So what a glide crack is so the whole snowpack, so this, we got a bunch of snow like September this year and then a big snowstorm in late October. And that came in with fairly wet snow and fairly warm weather. And there was a fair amount of water, like the ground wasn't frozen when that snow came in. So essentially what happens is the entire snowpack starts gliding down the mountain, just starts sliding down the mountain. And so it'll create these enormous cracks. It's like a crevasse on a glacier, essentially. And it goes all the way down to the ground. Earlier this season, there was a massive amount of glide cracks throughout the area, but they're starting to slow down now with cold temperatures and more snow, but they're still out there and they can release huge avalanches spontaneously. Like there's no way to predict when it's going to happen. So it's kind of a scary type of avalanche hazard because it's really unpredictable and creates very large avalanches. Well, glide cracks are something to look out for, both like if you're traveling on a slope, you can fall in them and that would be a bummer. Or if you're traveling up, skinning up, or riding a snow machine in a valley underneath them, they could release and catch you. So something to be aware of. The other thing right now is just low snow cover. Like we have really good snow coverage up at higher elevations, like above, you know, even 1500 feet, it's pretty good. But at the kind of pass level, like between 700 and 1000 feet, there's still quite a bit of vegetation out and it can be easy to get hurt if you catch a ski on an alder or put your snow machine into a tree well or something like that that you don't see. So kind of those are more standard early season kind of conditions that it's kind of getting to and from the car. That's the hardest part. Once you're up in the mountains, it's
right.
Feels normal, but yeah.
Well, and something I'm curious about too is, of course, you know, the way that we're experiencing winter is changing as kind of our climate is changing. And I'm curious if that has any sort of trickle down effects into how we're experiencing avalanches in Alaska.
That's a
big question and we might not know, but I'm wondering if that's something you've studied at all.
I haven't studied that personally. I think one thing that has a pretty big impact on us, I would maybe say more so than climate change in the short term scale, is like these, this is maybe a total, not a good place to go, but there's these El Nino and La Nina. Have you heard about this? It's like a weather phenomenon that happens based on ocean temperatures mm-hmm. down the equator. Mm-hmm. But it has a really big bearing on the type of snowpack we have typically. Mm. It can influence the type of snowpack we have. Currently, we're in a La Nina, and it tends to have colder temperatures and better snowpacks down at lower elevations here. There's definitely exceptions to that rule. The tricky thing with talking about climate is it's you can be wrong really easily because it's calculated on long time scales. So if you try and say like, oh, the conditions today are because of climate change, it's like, well, that's not really how climate works.
But. Right. And we are experiencing a colder winter we're expected to experience a colder winter this year. Right. But yeah. which doesn't bear on our kind of the longer term trends. I see what you're saying. It's complicated to talk in the short and the long term both at the same time.
Yeah, but I guess another answer to your question with climate change stuff. I know, like wet avalanches are becoming a more kind of attracting more research interest in the snow science field because wet avalanches typically happen in the spring when you have meltwater in the snowpack, either from the sun or from rain. And they can be similar to glides, actually. They can be really catastrophic and spontaneous in terms of when they release. And climate change seems like it's trending towards having more wet avalanche activity because we have warmer temps in general at higher elevations. So that's one thing that I think is kind of on the radar.
Hmm.
But,
another factor that seems to be impacting avalanche safety a bit is the number of people who are out recreating. I know that last year there was concern that the litany of folks coming out during COVID would maybe have some bearing on the avalanches occurring in Turnagain Pass specifically. I'm curious, Nick, if that's something that you're worried about or that you've kind of been paying attention to at all, is maybe how the amount of people recreating perhaps has a bearing on avalanche risk here.
Yeah, it's no joke that the amount of outdoor users has skyrocketed. Even pre-COVID days, you know, generally speaking, over the last handful of years or so, the outdoor recreation sector has been climbing. And then, COVID hit, and man, I mean, it exploded. Backcountry skiing specifically, and also I know, you know, snow machining, just based off of like snow machine sales, were records, you know, people trying to leave ski resorts and get outside more, which is great, you know, all about people getting out in their public land that we all have. And man, Alaska is about as good as it gets, right? So with the question you had really there, I mean, I guess overcrowding, you know, is an issue just for safety, just because you've got people above you or below you, and it gets a little more complicated to try to move around safely because we, you know, if we're getting into avalanche terrain or near avalanche terrain, we want to be spaced way out and only, you know, putting one person into that exposure area at a time. So that does kind of change your maneuverability, I guess, out there. And then I think, you know, for new folks getting out there, I think there's this like perception, you know, you see on social media and on the ski movies that you just like, oh yeah, you go back and skiing and you know, like ski avalanche terrain. And I think that it's really important to manage your own expectations and just lowering your expectations provides a better, I think, avenue to being out there and realizing that like you don't always want to get into that much drain. I mean, like I said earlier.
Yeah. What percentage of the time, if you had to estimate, would you say that you decide not to ski something because of avalanche risk?
It's going to vary, you know, season to season, year to year, month to month. But percentage wise, I don't know. I mean, I honestly, it'd be fun to track that, but I would say maybe only 25% of the time am I going to want to go into a big avalanche slope, or not even big, but a small avalanche slope. I also have a different risk assessment. You know, I mean, I'm out there all the time, and so I cannot get away with getting into avalanche terrain all the time. Otherwise, I'd be dead already. You know, someone that gets out twice a year, just probability wise, is going to have less chance, but I'm out there all the time. So I got to be really, really careful. And my life goal, I don't have many life goals, but my life goal is to like not get an avalanche or not have anybody in my group be avalanche. So I try to keep hopefully a lower risk assessment. And yeah, again, like you'll see people out there and riding slopes that are prone to avalanching and you don't see anything happen. And, you know, they just get away with it, and they it's this poor learning feedback environment. And so you just got to remember that that's a thing out there. But it's all about managing your expectations, I think.
Well, we have a minute and a half left, but before we go, John, I want to ask you, where can folks find the avalanche forecast? Where should they be looking for that information?
Yeah, the website for the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center is cnfaic.org. So that's the acronym. And that website also hosts observations, like I was talking about public observations earlier, and that those observations also come from the Chugach Front Range, from Summit Lake area, across the Kenai, really, Lost Lake area, and also Hatcher Pass. So it's kind of a hub for submitting public observations. Hatcher Pass has their own avalanche center that do the forecasting, but observations are hosted there. So you can find a lot of good information, weather links on that website.
And do you want people who are listening to submit their own observations?
Absolutely. Yeah. We love getting observations from the public. You see an avalanche, get a collapse or a woomph or whatever. It's, you know, there's only three of us, so we can only cover so much terrain.
Three forecasters.
Mm-hmm. And so public observations are a huge tool for us to put out a good product.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's about all the time we have for this Kenai conversation. A huge thank you to our guests today, John Sykes, Nick D'Alessio, and Sully. You can find this conversation online later at kdll.org. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our guests for being here. And everyone, stay safe out there in the backcountry.